सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्वषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। Last week we began the Sadhana Chatushtayam, understanding what the Sadhana Chatushtayam is. And we talked about Viveka and Viraga or Vairagya. And these are meant to really to disentangle us from the trivial, to create a relative freedom and objectivity, and to nurture a contemplative disposition, a contemplative attitude. When we talk about qualifications, the sadhana chatushtaya sampanna adhikari, the qualified student who is endowed with these qualifications, it's not like a college entrance board. It's not like there's somebody with a legal pad and a pencil checking off our qualifications to see if we are allowed admission into this University of Moksha. Well, you did very well on the SATs, but your Shama and Dhamma and your Mumukshutvam are a little wanting, so reapply next year. Really, what we mean by the qualification is that they're qualities of our mind and our emotional maturity. And why they're important, when you go to university, they don't ask you if you have Shama, Dhamma, Viveka, Ityadi, etc. They ask you if you're qualified, you have the prerequisites for this given field of knowledge, but this given field of inquiry and knowledge here is ourselves. So there's a unique set of qualifications, and these qualifications are the sadhana chatushtayam. And they're very personal because the subject matter is very personal, and there's a lot that can stand in the way of us fully appreciating the depth and the beauty of this teaching. So these qualities are natural qualities for a jnani, for one who knows, who has the tattva bodhaha. The jnani is one who has jnanam, atmajnanam, who knows oneself, who knows the creation. These are natural qualities. Viveka and Vairagya are natural to him or her, right? It's like a man, a bald man walking through an aisle with shampoo. There's just absolute vairagya because things are in their own place. Those qualities that are natural for a jnani, for a wise one, are our spiritual practice. They are our sadhana to the degree that we don't embody those naturally. And therefore, they require attention. They require choice. You could say they require will, but they require our attention and choice, viveka, the discriminative discernment here between the nitya nitya vastu viveka, the discriminative discernment between what is substantial, what is valuable, what is nitya, what is non-time bound, and what is incidental, what is trivial, what comes and goes and really doesn't solve the fundamental problem. That assimilated viveka manifests as vairagya in our life. These are the first two that we talked about. Vairagya is, we talked about balloons and we talked about shampoo. It's just everything in its own place. We don't attribute value to experiences or to pursuits or the objects which they don't deserve. So in this sense, the viveka is a purushartha nischaya, an ascertainment of really what artha kama and dharma can possibly give us. And we see that they have their place. Wealth, security, comfortable circumstances, punya, they have their place, but they only go so far. Because behind all those desires for any particular thing is this tambura. This is my tambura here. That tambura of I want, I want, I want, I want. And when we see that really what we want is to quiet, to resolve that drone of desire into the silence of my own purnatvam, my own completeness, then we become mumukshus, those who desire moksha. So these next six qualities we want to look into. I will say this sentence once or a few words once, and we'll repeat them together. We'll start with, we already saw, nitya nitya vastu vivekaha, viragaha kaha, shamadhi shatka sampattihi ka. Let's start with that. Shamadhi shatka sampattihi ka. Shamadhi shatka sampattihi ka. Now, in this next line, there's actually a typo. It should say titiksha. There's shamo dhamma uparamas. It says tiksha. It should say titiksha. There should be two titi. Titiksha. There. All right. Shamo dhamma. Shamo dhamma. Uparamaha. Uparamaha. Titiksha. Titiksha. Shraddha. Shraddha. Samadhanam cheti. Samadhanam cheti. So the student asks, shamadhi shatka sampattihi, what is this sampattihi, this wealth or this accomplishment, this sixfold accomplishment, shama, etc. And then he lists them. He says, shamaha, dhammaha, uparamaha, titiksha, shraddha, samadhanam cha, iti, and iti just puts everything behind it in quotes. So let's go on here. Let's take the first two. Shamaha kaha. Shamaha kaha, shamaha kaha, mano nigraha, mano nigraha, dhammaha kaha, dhammaha kaha, chakshuradi, chakshuradi, bahyendriya, bahyendriya, nigraha, nigraha. So these qualities, these qualifications, if you will, as I mentioned, are meant to build an inner contemplativeness. It gives us the ability to have choice, really, and to focus on what's important. When they develop, and when we have some degree of them, they give us a mind which can dwell on this teaching and on the truth of myself with ease. And if they're not there, like I mentioned, that becomes our sadhana. That's what we need to put our attention to and our even will to attempt to manifest. And if they shape these shama, etc., they shape our inner life and our relationship with the world and allow us to develop an inner leisure. There's often a great amount of pressure that comes from various sources. And the shama, dhamma, etc., help us build an inner leisure which is necessary to have the time and the spaciousness to dwell on and contemplate on and really see in depth this teaching. And they're all taken from the Upanishads. The Brihadaranyakopanishad says shantaha, dantaha, etc. So these are not something that this author is introducing. They're straight from the Upanishads. And they're shamaha, dhammaha, uparamaha. Uparamaha is sometimes called uparatihi. Titiksha, shraddha, samadhanam cha iti. So let's take dhammaha first. Let's kind of switch it around. Dhammaha, dhammaha kaha, we saw chakshuradi bahyendriya nigraha. Nigraha is sometimes translated as control or mastery. But really what it is the capacity to have a choice. It's a capacity to have a choice regarding the indriyas, bahyendriya. Bahya means external. Indriya means, it's often translated as a sense. it doesn't translate well into English. And we will go over this in a lot more detail later. But there's actually 10 indriyas. Indriya nigraha. These indriyas, they actually talk about 10 of them. There's 5 for input and 5 for output, if you will. They're capacities. They're capacities to take information in and the capacity for output, to contribute to the world. So the 5 senses that we know are the hearing, you know, sight, etc. Then those are called the jnana indriyas. Those are the sense capacities, the capacities for knowledge. And then there's the karma indriyas. We'll be covering all this in detail later on in the book. But there's the karma indriyas, which are the capacities for action. And so there's actually 10 indriyas they talk about, 11, if you consider the mind as another capacity, as another instrument. So there's instruments for input. Coming from a computer science background, I can't help it. There's a capacity for input and a capacity for output. And so this includes both of those. The output includes our mouth for speaking, our hands for doing, our feet for going, etc. So these are the bahyendriyas. And the reason that he says bahyendriya is the external, because these are the ways we interact with our world, either through allowing things in or creating things, manifesting things, interacting with the world. And then the next one, shama, is, and it doesn't say this, but it's the antahkarana, the mind. It addresses the mind. The mind is the antahkarana, the inner instrument. And so that's how they break these out. Dhamma is a mastery of the external indriyas. In other words, how we relate to the world, what we let in, and what we allow out. And mastery, again, seems to imply a rigidity. Sometimes they say a control, you know, as if there was this yogi in this padmasana who never moves, the capacity just to stay, you know. But it's really a matter of having choice. And chakshuradi bahyendriya. So chakshuhu is a mind, are the eyes. Adi means the first thing. So that group of indriyas, which begins with the eyes, etc. So it just means all 10 of these. So what does this really mean? Let's say I'm walking down the street and someone walks up to me and looks me in the eyes and says, "You're ugly and your mother dresses you funny." Okay? Someone comes up and insults me. What are my choices there? If I have no dhamma, then I have no choices. I just have a reaction. Either I will, if I'm prone to violence, I may hit them. If I am perhaps a little more refined, I will yell at them, or less refined, I will curse at them. If they're big and I'm short, you know, I may kick them. I don't know. You know, that anger, that reaction. You know, if there's someplace in me that really feels ugly, and if my mother really does dress me funny, then I have a problem if I can't respond properly. So dhamma here means controlling what I say and what I do. Do I hit them? Do I yell at them? Do I curse at them? Do I turn around and I walk away? If I have a reaction and I have the wherewithal to turn around and walk away, just smile, preferably, and just turn around and walk away, I have some dhamma. I have some control over my actions, over how I respond to given situations. The capacity to say, if someone comes up to you, and maybe in a less egregious situation, and says something that makes you angry, if you have the capacity to say, "I feel angry right now, let's talk about this later." That is dhamma, in fact. It shows a certain emotional maturity. It means that I have a say, I have a choice over how I respond. In other words, reactions turn into responses. And I could be filled with rage because my mother really does dress me funny, has bugged me forever. But still, I have the capacity to turn around and walk away and say, "Let's talk about this later." And so, in a sense, it's drawing healthy boundaries. And we all have these buttons, and we all have these these areas of vulnerability where we really feel like, oh, maybe I am such and such. And when someone calls me out on some of these things, I can easily become angry or hurt or whatever. So the ability to let's say, let's look at Jnanin Indriyas, right? So let's look at our tongue. You know, in that previous situation, Vaktapas, the capacity for Vaktapas to bite our tongue and just say, bye, and turn around and walk away, or I'm feeling angry, we'll talk later, that is Vaktapas. And that's an expression of Dhamma. Another expression of Dhamma would be, does our tongue decide what it is we eat? What if I have a value for ahimsa, but I grew up in a culture, in a McDonald's hamburger eating culture? And so perhaps someone is torn between their value for not killing cows and their desire for a cheeseburger. I don't know how someone can have a desire for a cheeseburger, but it's apparently a lot of people do. And let's say I have I'm very influenced by advertising and I don't just want one cheeseburger. I want to supersize that. And I want fries and a 20-ounce Coca-Cola. And I want that for breakfast and I want that for lunch and I want that for dinner. Who's in charge? I'm not in charge. My tongue's in charge. And that's going to get me into trouble. And it doesn't allow me to manifest my value for ahimsa, for nonviolence. If I still have a lingering desire for eating dead animals, and I choose not to, I go for the broccoli, I go for the quinoa, I go for the dal and the sabji and the rice. When I have that craving for something more violent, something that's not vegetarian, that's Dhamma. Because I have a pressure to act in a certain way and I choose not to. For someone to have Dhamma, really it's meaningful when there's that pressure to act otherwise. When I have a value for ahimsa and I choose to act in accordance with my values, I choose to not say those nasty words, those mean words that come to mind. When I choose not to eat food that has been created from violence and cruelty, that's an expression of Dhamma. I'm going contrary to that pressure. And, you know, in a sense, it's character building. And in a sense, that's where, you know, the tapas, we talked last week a little bit about the tapas. If I'm addicted to certain types of food, it's interesting to fast on Ekadashi, right? Every culture, every spiritual tradition has these little austerities. Like when I was a kid, I grew up Catholic. When I was a child, we'd give certain things up for Lent. You know, Muslims during Ramadan, they fast during the day. Every culture has the notion of creating situations that create that tension between our inclination, our pressure to do certain things to, and our resolution not to. And when those resolutions are based on our value structure, like ahimsa, or our value for not becoming obese and filling our arteries with cholesterol, and we actually do that, that is an expression of Dhamma. Shamaha, on the other hand, shamaha is mano nigraha. So you see that that Dhamma is indriya nigraha. The same word is being used, nigraha. In the first case, it's bahyendriya nigraha for Dhamma, and shamaha is mano nigraha. Manas, the mind, the antakarana, the inner instrument. It's a resolution of the mind or mastery of the mind. But again, it is more of a capacity to have a choice as to where the mind goes and a capacity to let thoughts go. It's having a mind that is available to me and serves me. Sometimes this mano nigraha is said to be a destruction of the mind or a suppression of the mind, but it's not. It's a very gentle handling of the mind. We need to nurture a reactive mind. So let's say I walk away from the fellow who accused me of being ugly and wearing my mom addressing me funny. We walk away, but we're still angry. How do we process that anger? You know, Pooja Swamiji actually goes into, he said, go beat your pillow up. Go into your room and pound on that pillow and use your words, meaning that he was encouraging people to actually curse, right? In the privacy of your own room, get those emotions out. Let them out. Don't judge yourself by it. There's a reason. There's an order. There's a psychological, emotional order to the world. So don't be shy in letting that anger out towards the pillow. Don't do it towards somebody you love or someone who comes up to you in the street. Do it in the privacy. Process those feelings. That can be thought to be a practice of shama because you're processing that reactive mind trying to nurture a calm, accepting disposition towards your mind so you can let those thoughts come and go. There's many ways to do this. Writing in a journal. Writing that letter that's filled with vitriol and then deleting it, making sure you don't press that send button. That's your tapas. You can write anything you want. Just don't press that send button. Writing in your journal, I find that very useful because it helps put those thoughts out in front of you and say, wow, look at that. Where does that come from? There's also other meditation practices. There's you know, even psychotherapy. There's a lot of ways to process this tension and this emotional reactivity that we have. But in the end, shama is a capacity to exercise choice regarding the content of our thoughts. Shamaha is the ability, a spaciousness around our thoughts. So at first, when someone comes up and insults us and we really feel touched by that insult, we will react, and that will take us away. It may take us away for days. It may be like having a sore tooth, and we just can't keep our tongue away from it. Our mind will just keep coming back again and again. Why did that person say that I was ugly? Am I really ugly? You know, you look in the mirror and say, you know, maybe I need to do a makeover. You know, maybe I shouldn't let my mother be dressing me. Maybe she doesn't have the best taste in clothing. You know, maybe you can think about it, but your mind keeps coming back again and again, and you don't have any control over that. When you have shama, when you have, quote unquote, mastery over the mind, really you have the capacity to let it go. It's not like you grab onto the mind and squeeze it so you control it. You can let the thoughts come, you can let the thoughts be, and you can let the thoughts go. And you are not beating yourself up for having certain thoughts. The mind is meant to think. The mind is quicksilver. The mind will go in all sorts of places that you're embarrassed to even to admit that it might go. But do you beat yourself up for that? Swamiji is very fond of saying, if he says, you know, someone in an interview will come up, will ask him, who knows nothing about Vedanta, and they'll say, what's the one thing you want people to know about Vedanta? And he will say, don't judge yourself by the obtaining condition of your mind. And he actually says this to complete novices. And at the end of a three-year course, it's very beautiful. He'll give his final talk at a three-year course where people were studying Vedanta every day for hours a day, meditating, doing seva, all that. And at the end, he says, when you leave here, don't judge yourself by the obtaining condition of your mind. Don't beat yourself up. You, and we'll see this much more clearly, but my thoughts do not define me. I am not a bad person because I have quote-unquote bad thoughts. I am not a good person because I have quote-unquote good thoughts. Thoughts come just like the sounds in today's meditations. The sounds come, the sounds are, the sounds go. Thoughts come, thoughts exist, thoughts go, emotions come. In Vedanta, when we talk about the mind, when we talk about thoughts, that includes emotions too. Manaha is the manas. Manas is the seat of emotions, our whole inner life. Thoughts and emotions, they come, they stay, they go. Shamaha is a capacity just to let things go. That's what we mean by mastery. it doesn't hook us. And then we don't, and we also don't do that double judgment, right? So we have a thought, we don't want that thought. Good people don't have that thought. Now I'm a bad person because I had that thought. Now I'm a bad person because I'm having judgmental thoughts about my mind. Now I'm a bad person because I'm having judgmental thoughts about me having judgmental thoughts about my mind. You know, it's like a flowing river. Thoughts come and thoughts go. And it's the capacity to direct my mind where I want it to go. I can let thoughts go, but if I spend all my, if I choose to allow my thoughts, and this will come up later, maybe more appropriately in a later quality here. If I choose to let my thoughts continue to dwell on cheeseburgers, that's a disgusting example. I should find something different. On a chocolate cake, it can be very seductive. I'm not going to eat chocolate cake, but I'm going to be thinking about chocolate cake all the time, every day when I wake up. If I could just have chocolate cake, you know, Shamatha is just to let that go, saying, not only do I'm not a bad person for thinking of chocolate cake, I can make a choice to allow that chocolate cake to go, and I can think of something else. I can think of something more important. That's a part of Shema as well. So it's ability to process reactions, to release these sources, and however we find a way to release these sources of pain and anger and hatred and jealousy, you know, and to not judge ourselves by the presence of those, but to find tools to address them. Again, through prayer, through journaling, through expressing those in a safe environment, through getting them out, to talking with people who know, either professionals or friends. You know, there's a lot of ways to process some of these feelings so that the next time someone walks up to me and says, "You're ugly and your mother dresses you funny," I can laugh and go, "You're right." Then I'm free. I only need Dhamma when Shama is not there. If I can just laugh at it, or I can have that reaction and I can laugh at that reaction. If I go, "What do you mean?" And you see through that, you see it's just a remnant of my insecure little child, you know, my little adolescent self who was insecure with how I looked when I was 12 years old. And my mother did dress me funny. If I can have compassion for that inner 12-year-old who has those feelings and laugh and let it go, there's no confrontation. There's no need for Dhamma if that Shama is there. Okay, that is Shama and Dhamma. Uparamaha. Uparamaha kaha. Uparamaha kaha. Swadharma, swadharma, anushtanam, anushtanam, eva, eva. So this is the third quality, uparamaha. And it's actually taken in two different ways. We'll look at both of these. Really what this is an expression of mumukshutvam in my life. Mumukshutvam, again, is the desire for freedom. It's desire to solve the fundamental problem in a fundamental way. And it's an expression of how that mumukshutvam manifests in my life vis-a-vis where I place my attention and what I do. It's a one-pointedness in my pursuit of moksha. I heard someone once describe it as, I'm not a dilettante. This desire for moksha is not just a passing fancy. It's not one of my top 10 things. You know, I'm serious about this because there's really nothing else to do. When you have the viveka, you have the vairagya. When you see that, oh, you know, should I go to a movie or should I go to a Vedanta class? You say, well, what's my ROI? What's the best way to spend an hour and a half to go see people dancing in the hills and, or, you know, CGI graphics of monsters, or to listen to how beautiful I am as my very being, as my truth, is that I am the source of all beauty. I'm the source of all joy. Then what's more entertaining? When you have a certain perspective on the world through this teaching, everything becomes a movie. Everything becomes entertaining. Everything becomes more entertaining than the best movie because it's all this melodrama around you. This life unfolding just around you becomes the best entertainment you could have. Anyway, so one way to look at this, as he expresses it here, is Swadharma Anushtanam. Anushtanam, sta means to, is the Sanskrit dhatu sta tishtati, to stand. Anushtana means following, standing in accordance with. Swadharma, in accordance with one's own dharma. And what's meant by swadharma here is swakarma, one's own actions, one's kartavyam, one's karyam. What that means is what is calling you to be done. What is calling you? Many times our circumstances call us. Sometimes a calling can come from within, many times from without. And we have to listen very carefully. Sometimes in a very traditional society, if there's varnashrama dharma, and we don't need to go into that too much, but if your social position and your position in life call you to do certain actions and have a certain lifestyle, then that is your swadharma. If you're a brahmachari, if you're a student, you have different responsibilities than if you're a grahastha, if you're a householder. And then you have different duties than if you're a sannyasi, if you're a vanaprastha or a sannyasi, if you're retired, you have different duties than, you know, you don't have to go to the office every day. If you are a monk, if you're a renunciate, you have different responsibilities. And if you're a politician, you have different responsibilities than if you're an educator, if you're a brahmana, or if you're a kshatriya or vaishya, if you're a businessman, or if you're a blue-collar worker, shudra. Each of these positions and each of these stages of life have different responsibilities associated with them. If you're in a less traditional society, in a sense of that your duties are less explicit, then you have to just look around you and you have to be sensitive. If you have an ailing relative, perhaps your duty, you know, we use this word duty. Some of us are uncomfortable with it because it sounds so patriarchal and hierarchical, and it's your duty to do this. But really, what it's what your dharma is. It's what the world is calling you to do, and those actions will be the most harmonious with what needs to be done. It's the most compassionate thing to do in the moment. It's the most giving thing to do in a moment. If you have a sick relative, perhaps your swadharma is to take care of them. If you have children, your swadharma is your swakarma. It's your to take care of your children. If you need to go to the office because you need to put food on the table. A lot of times what it is that we need to do is very obvious, and sometimes it's not. And when we talk about karma yoga, which we haven't gotten into in much detail yet, but those your various swadharma is your puja. Playing your role as the world asks of you is your devotional practice. Because everything here is Ishvara, everything here is the Lord. And when the creation asks you to do something and you do it, something that is healthy, right? I mean, the creation, you could have someone come up to you and say, hey, will you buy me some heroin? Your swadharma at that time is not to go buy that person heroin, you know? That's not the best thing for anyone in that situation. So it's not that your dharma is to become codependent. It's not that your dharma is to have no boundaries. It's not that your swadharma is to give of yourself so much that you lose yourself and you have no capacity to give anymore. In certain circumstances, you need to do that. In certain circumstances, you need to give your all. But it has to be an intelligent giving. And so just because people are asking from you, you need to see really what the best way to serve them is. Is what they're asking for really the best thing for the situation? when you have a six-year-old child, they may want candy bars for breakfast. Is giving them candy bars for breakfast the best way to serve them? I doubt it. So you have to use your best judgment. And in the realm of dharma, there is vishesha dharma and samanya dharma. We've mentioned this a bit before. Samanya dharma is the general dharma. And the vishesha dharma is how you manifest that general dharma in specific situations. Dharma is very situational, right? We have the samanya dharma, do no harm, ahimsa. And yet, how do we really manifest that? It's harm for me to give my child candy bars for breakfast. But that little child may cry if they don't get candy for breakfast. So I appear to be doing harm because I'm causing them misery, but I know better. My wisdom informs my actions. Sometimes our calling, our dharma, we need to hear what our next steps are. You know, especially when it comes to life choices, what do I choose in life? Sometimes we have to listen very closely as to really what the next step is in our life, because sometimes it's very muddled. Someone may want us to do may not be really the best for us, but because we value this person's input, we struggle to try to clarify really what our swadharma is. It's not necessarily an easy thing, but it's meant to create a harmony in our life and to allow us to practice karma yoga, to allow us to see the experiences that our life presents as means to create the disposition, the quietude, the compassion, and the contemplativeness to fully assimilate this teaching. And our whole life gives us that experience, and that's what karma yoga is. And it allows us to create a life of non-conflict, both externally and internally. So really, the Swadharma Anushtanam is living life as a sadhaka. It's transforming every experience into our sadhana. Sadhaka is sadhanam karoti, one who does sadhana, who does spiritual practice. Now, another way to interpret this, uparama or uparittihi, is sannyasa. So that's why they say swadharma anushtana or sannyasa. Sannyasa is in a sense the same thing as doing one's dharma, in a sense that you're focused on what you're called to do. And some people are in a position where all they want to do is this sadhana. All they want to do is this study, is this meditation and contemplation. And they want to teach, or they want to study, or they want to do service to other people. And their circumstances allow that. And so they take sannyasa. Really, it's like I said, this uparamaha is a manifestation of mumukshutvam in your life. It's a manifestation of your desire, your spiritual seeking, your desire to be free. And if your circumstances are such that you have obligations and duties and you have responsibilities, then that becomes your sadhana. And if you don't have that, if you're in a situation where you don't have those requirements, sannyasa is an option. Sannyasa is becoming a sannyasi, becoming a monk, really just letting those other occupations go because this is your main interest. This is where the juice of your life is. This is what gives you the satisfaction because you're coming home again and again and again when you see this, when you study, when you meditate, when you contemplate. You come home again and again and again. So sometimes this uparittihi is translated as sannyasa. And really both, doing one's dharma, swadharma, or taking sannyasa, becoming a monk, are really quieting your worldly engagement. Really, when you do karma yoga, you're quieting your worldly engagement. You're letting distractions go, and you're focusing on what's important. It's creating a simple life. When you do your swadharma, when you play your role, when you choose to do what's best for yourself and for the situation, any situation, swadharma, you simplify your life. Life becomes a lot less complicated. If you're doing adharma, if you're cheating and lying And if you're off trying to explore the vast world of sensual pleasures, it can be very distracting, and you can lose yourself again and again. So this upariti, even in the sense of swadharma anushtana or sannyasa, it's meant just to simplify your life so you can focus on what your highest priority is. Let's go to titiksha. Titiksha ka, shitoshna, sukadukkadi, sahishnutvam. One reason I didn't give a translation, a book which translate this, is because some of the translations, they're not particularly good. Often, sahishnutvam is translated as fortitude, endurance. Again, so fortitude and endurance sound like a very troublesome thing. They sound like endurance, like an endurance run, like you're very stressed out and you're at your wit's end and you struggle. It's a huge struggle. And really what sahishnutvam is allowing things to be as they are, that come and go. That's why we did that meditation today. We really don't demand, unless there's a huge sound, annoying sound that's giving us a headache, we can let sound come, we can let sound stay, we can let sound go. Really, sahishnutvam is the ability to accommodate what? Shita, ushna, sukha, dukkhadi. Shita, cold, ushna, heat, sukha, pleasant experience, dukkha, unpleasant experiences, opportunities, a lack of opportunities, any sensation that we get. So in terms of sound, we can have a very accommodating mind. We don't need to demand that the sounds be different than they are. But often we demand that the world is different than it happens to come to us. The nature of the world is dwandva. The nature of the world is duality, is ups and downs, a pairs of opposites. The duality of experience is universal, is inevitable, and it's impermanent, right? The jagat, the world of our experience, jagat, jayate gacchati iti jagat. If you're in my beginning Sanskrit class, you should recognize one of those words, jayate gacchati, gacchati iti jagat. Jayate, it's born, gacchati, it goes. It comes, it goes, it comes, it goes. That's the nature of the world. And they come in pairs. Even avatars cannot escape this. The sometimes pleasant situations, unpleasant situations. Look at Rama. One day he was the heir apparent to the throne. The next day he's wandering in the forest. Right? Even avatars cannot escape this up and down that life has to offer. There's a song, one line of which goes, sometimes you're the windshield, sometimes you're the bug. Sometimes you're the windshield, sometimes you're the bug. When you're driving along, especially in the desert, you'll have these bugs that'll just pop your windshield. And sometimes you're the splattered bug, and sometimes you're the splattered windshield. Things come and things go, and sometimes they're pleasant and sometimes they're unpleasant. And we have these models of how the world should be, and we label experiences as good or bad, as desirable or undesirable. And we think we know the way things should be. There was a farmer, and he had a horse that he used for plowing. I know they don't use horses in India for plowing, so this must not have happened in India. And his horse one day ran away. And his neighbors all came up to him and said, oh, my goodness, your horse ran away. What are you going to do? That's horrible. How are you going to possibly plow your fields? And the farmer looked and said, perhaps. 2 days later, the horse comes back, not just by itself, but with five other horses, wild horses. And the neighbors come up to him and they say, how lucky you are. You now have six horses. Look at all the horsepower you have now. You now have six horsepower. You're such a lucky man. The farmer says, perhaps. His son now needs to train these horses, needs to tame these horses. His son is out there on one of these wild horses, and he falls and he breaks his leg. Oh, my poor neighbor, his neighbor says, how unfortunate, your son broke his leg. Now he won't be able to help you with the farming. You're so unfortunate. Perhaps. 3 days later, an army comes by and they're conscripting people for a battle that's ensuing. And they see this boy with a broken leg and they say, we can't take him. We can't take him. He can't fight. He's injured. And the neighbors come and say, you're so lucky. And the man says, say it with me. Perhaps. So we never know. We never know. We label things as fortunate and unfortunate, as sukha and dukkha, and we really never know in the scheme of things. When we look back on our lives, sometimes what we have labeled to be an unfortunate situation, we look back upon with gratitude, because we see that even though it was uncomfortable at the time, it was a growing situation for us. We appreciate the struggle. We appreciate it. And if we had the choice back then, we wouldn't have welcomed that situation. We would not have voted to have that as one of our experiences in our life. But now in hindsight, I am the person I am because of all those experiences. And I can be grateful for even those unpleasant experiences. And sometimes those pleasant experiences, maybe were not so great for us. It's the nature of the world. Jayate gachati, it comes and goes. As I mentioned, maybe in one of the first couple classes, how do you make a sad man happy and a happy man sad? You say to him, this too shall pass. So if you have no titiksha, when you're happy and someone says, this too shall pass, then you become sad. And when you're sad and you say, someone comes to you and says, this too shall pass, you become happy. Now, what if you have titiksha? What if you have this fortitude, this endurance? What if you have that? When you're happy and someone says, this too shall pass, you say, I know. When you're unhappy and someone says, this too shall pass, you say, I know. And you can endure them, which really means that there may be a struggle. And when there's a struggle, that is your sadhana. That's what you pay attention to, and that's where will comes, and that's where choice comes. Over time, these things become easier because you see it's the nature of the world. Your viveka kicks in, and you say, oh, this experience won't last. This experience won't last. Shitoshna sukadukadi. I can offer no resistance. I don't become sad when the creation is not giving me what it is I think I want. And it really tunes the mind. Now, I have to be careful when I say you offer no resistance to what is, because it doesn't mean that you don't act to change situations if they need to be changed. But you don't offer resistance to what is. Everything is prasadam. Everything is grace. Everything is just like you would accept after a devotional practice, after a puja, as you would accept water or milk or flour that's coming from the deity, right? With gratitude. That's how you accept everything that comes. That's prasada buddhi of karma yoga. And you offer no resistance to what comes. But you can change what's in front of you if it needs to be changed, right? If the little child broke into the cookie jar and started eating cookies, you can say, oh, look, look what just happened. You don't have to get angry. You can accept that at that moment, that's just what happened. It doesn't mean that you don't go there and take the cookies away from the little child, right? You can still respond to the world in a way that it needs to respond, but you don't have to have that. You don't have to get riled. You don't need to have that reactivity. You have an equanimity to what comes and what goes, just as the sound. The sound comes, the sound goes, and I remain the same. Like in the meditation essay, I said from the second chapter of Gita, Matras Parashastu Kanteya Shitoshna Sukadukadaha Agamapayano Nityaha Tamsa Tikshasubharata. He says, Krishna says, Tams Tatikshaswa. Tatikshaswa is a second person imperative singular verb, which means do this. Do what? Do Tatiksha. Tan Tatiksha. Tatikshaswa. Do have Tatiksha towards this. Towards what? Shita Ushna Sukha Dukha. Because he says that the matra sparshaha, the contacts of the senses with the sense objects, daha, shitoshna sukha dukha daha, they give these experiences which are pleasant and unpleasant. And agamapayanaha, they come and they go. Anityaha, they are temporary, they are fleeting. These things come and they go. So just to the best of your ability, put up with them. Some things are easy to put up with. If it's hot, turn the air conditioning on. There's nothing wrong with that, unless you can't afford your electricity bill. There's nothing wrong with that. Take a dip in the pool. There's nothing wrong with that. If you have no air conditioning, if you have no pool, then just accommodate it. Don't be one of those. It's been hot here in San Diego these last few days, and you don't know how many times I've heard, oh, it's so hot. Oh, it's so hot. Oh, it was so hot yesterday. Oh, it's going to be so hot tomorrow. It's so hot. I was so hot. Oh, I'm cooler now. It's the evening. It's cool now. I was so hot. I was so hot. This dwelling of the mind on these experiences and on these unpleasant experiences, this is the lack of tatiksha. You don't need to dwell on those. You don't need these things to get the better of you. Krishna goes on to say, Yam hina vyatayantyete purusham purusharshapa samadukha sukham dhiram somrutatvaya kalpate. He says that Yam hina vyatayantyete purusham purusharshapa, O purusharshapa, O Arjuna, the man whom these do not really bother too much, he is that dhiram, that wise one, who sees dukkha and sukha as sama, sama sukha dukkham, sama dukkha sukham, one for whom both dukkha and sukha are the same, good opportunities and bad opportunities, pleasant experiences, unpleasant experiences. The horse runs away, the horse comes back. The son falls off the horse, the son doesn't get conscripted into the army. One who sees those with equanimity, he is Amrita-dvaya kalpate, saha, he is fit for amrita-dva. Amrita-dva means literally immortality, for freedom from death. For really what it means is this tattva-bodha. This is the power of this tatiksha. So really, there's no tension, or there's the capacity to deal with tense situations with some dhamma, right? If you have no tatiksha, then you exercise dhamma. If you can't put up with these unpleasant circumstances that come and go, then you just exercise a little vaktapas and you don't complain about it. And again, so this quality, the qualities of a wise person are our sadhana. So this is just something to pay attention to. And Swamiji uses this quite a bit in parts of his teaching of meditation, is this simple serenity prayer, 12-step program serenity prayer. Grant me the serenity to accept those things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I may not be quoting that exactly right, but really that is a very beautiful perspective, to be able to accept those things I cannot change, and yet still have the courage to change those things and the wisdom to know the difference between the two. So this is Shama, Dhamma, Uparamaha, and Titiksha. Next week we'll see Shraddha and Samadhanam and Mumukshutvam, and then we will go on to the Atma Vichara, which is the next section of the book. Let's sit for just a minute.
Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishah pro brahmane vyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshati parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamcho barahitah brahmana santu nirbhayah om sarve bhavantu sukhinah Sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchit dukkha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate, Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vishishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om Om Tat Sat Sarvam Ishvara Arpanamastu
Yes. Can I ask a question?
Please, please.
Yeah, I really liked your talk today about Sama Dhamma Shama.
Thank you.
The teacher, just lovely. One question which has bothered me in the past, I wonder if you could throw some light on that. And, you know, if somebody close to you, maybe your brother, your sister, your brother-in-law, sister-in-law, if they are always voicing negativity, they're always talking, you know, about their past and, you know, their difficulties and their unfortunate situations, etc., etc. I mean, obviously, you're concerned about them and you are listening to them. But then to get that kind of vairagya or the dispassion, and then, of course, you might even tell them that, look, past is past, you must forgive the past, and so on and so forth. But then, when it doesn't have any effect on them, when they still continue in that same light, and you become sort of worried that, look, this person is maybe really spoiling his or her health, and, you know, he's creating, or she's creating an environment of unhappiness around herself or himself. And how do we then, practice? I know it's, I can't be indifferent to it. I can't switch off from that, truly. But then I know that, well, this is something that I hope he or she will come over, get over, but it does affect, I'm honest, it does affect me.
Yes, yes.
I can feel that it affects me, and I'm not able to do anything about it except occasionally saying something which I hope helps. You understand my prop. So, yes. I try not to be angry or judgmental about what somebody says. But at the end of it, I feel, okay, I've done my best. And I can't do more than that. So there is a lurking sense of incompleteness or my inability to change the situation. I hope I'm not.
Yeah, no, what you describe is a very real and very difficult situation. And it sounds like you're approaching it with compassion, and yet, I mean, it's a fierce grace. That's the term I've heard for it, fierce grace, because you have compassion for this person, and yet they're a given in your life, right? If you don't have, if they're just a friend who's always expressing negativity, then you have some choice how much time to spend with them. But if they're a family member then it's you sometimes don't have the choice. You have to be there with them. And you see how the sort of the dark cloud that they're always surrounding themselves with, and it's self-generating. And all they can, and oftentimes they just see the bad. They see how they're a victim. They see how you know, and they some people play the martyr. Some people feel like everybody else has all the opportunities and I don't have any opportunities. And you tell me the best way to work with that. It's difficult, especially with family members, because they know your buttons too. You want to approach them with as much compassion. And you really, what we want to do is to solve their problem. We want them to change. And we see how they could change. And we see how they could benefit from a more loving disposition, how they could benefit from more tiksha, just letting things be as they are, from not playing the victim, and having gratitude. People who have gratitude in their lives are much happier. They've done all sorts of scientific studies that if you express gratitude, you're grateful and you live a happy life. And the people who don't express gratitude express the opposite of that. They live a very, it's a hard life and it's a sad life. And when I'm in that situation, I have compassion, but it's very wearing. Because if you just hear that again and again and again, this is where the practice of letting people be as they are. You only have limited capacity, right? You cannot change somebody. Someone has to change from within, from themselves. Some people are open to suggestions. Some people are not even open to suggestions. Who are you to try to fix me? You know? And personally, I'm just speaking from experience, sometimes it's actually beneficial to have a picture of them on your puja table. Because they are your sadhana, because you react to them on a variety of levels. You have compassion towards them, you have irritation towards them, you have sadness because this person is living such a sad life. You want them to be different. The only control you have is over your own reaction to them, your own response to them. And in the end, you can be happy. It sounds horrible to say, but you can be happy in spite of someone else's unhappiness. I mean, it sounds like you have no compassion when someone says that, but that's not true at all. You can have as much compassion as you can, and you can continue to do what is best for the situation, how to make their life as easy, as comfortable, and how to relieve their suffering as much as you can. And yet, you don't have to be miserable because they're miserable. And, you know, you can choose in some degree how much you listen to their complaining. You can try to direct the conversation. You can try to limit your time. Sometimes I find even changing the topic, talking about something happy, talking about something else sometimes works. I find I have to have healthy boundaries when it comes to situations like that. If I can see them as miserable as they see themselves, I have compassion and I see the hurt they're in and I can be bigger than them. I can have such an expansive heart that I can let them be as they choose to be or have no way out of. I can try to show them ways out. But if they cannot see that, I can still love them and I can be free even in their misery. Even in the midst of their misery, I can still be free. I don't have to be miserable because they're miserable. But that sounds so heartless. But really, that's the truth. I don't have to be miserable because someone else is miserable. I can see with clarity and have compassion and allow them to experience what they need to experience and try to do what I can to relieve their suffering. But I am not responsible, and I really have no control over it, necessarily over their experience.
Yeah, I think that was very, very, very good advice. Very good thoughts.
Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts on that? Do you have any?
No, I think one would need to sort of practice this consciously and then see for oneself the kind of results that you may have on yourself and on the other person or persons.
Practically two things that I do in that situation. I do a lot of japa, right? Even not just sitting doing japa with a japa mala, but I do japa while I'm in their presence, because I can easily get drawn into their self-pity and melodrama. So I just do japa as much as I can to bring myself back to myself as much as I can. The second thing is I actually created a little audio file that I play. Like if I'm in that situation and it becomes unbearable, I may go out and listen to this 3-minute meditation that I have made for myself just to deal with this specific situation, reminding myself that I am free in this situation. I can manifest compassion. I don't need to be drawn into that drama. I don't need to take responsibility if I'm really not contributing to that, to their suffering. I don't need to take responsibility for their suffering, and yet I can continue to try to be as compassionate and as understanding as I can. And sometimes you just can do what you can do, and that's all you can do.
You said you had this three minute meditation that you use. It would be great to have that.
No, that's not going out into the wild. It's a very personal thing based on my own needs, my own growth. You should make your own, because the other thing I was going to say is that the reason you can put their picture on your puja table, on your altar, is that when you're doing puja, you can, in your vision, see them in the context of the sacred. You can invoke that accommodating mind while you're doing puja towards that person that causes you trouble. And so even in meditation, like that's kind of what I tried to do in the meditations last week and the week before, is to bring someone up who's causing you this trouble, and bringing a bhavana, bringing an attitude of acceptance and loving, and letting them be as they are, giving them their own space. That's also a practice that you can do if you listen back to the previous meditations. But I'd encourage you, if you do your own. And in fact, you can just write it down. And when you reach a point of breaking, you can go and read that. And whatever it is that you need to remind yourself of, you know, we need to remind ourselves again. And we need to take space, because people who are very negative can very much drain us. And it can be very challenging sometimes. So we need to make sure we can maintain our own equanimity and our own composure in their presence. Because if we lose that and we become reactive, then we are just contributing to the problem and not to the solution.
Very true.
I was about to comment that one of the other solutions would be for them to come and attend this class. I mean, that's really true, right? Like, we ourselves could have been a pain in the butt for someone else, and going through this process definitely kind of keeps our mind in control and our emotions in check, right? So,
although, you know, there are some people who have an opportunity to pursue things spiritual and never have any need for it. It's just not in their prarabdha. It's just not in their destiny. They just have no interest in this at all. And you can't force people to have that. Some things help for some people. Some people find inspiration in one thing, and other people find inspiration in other things.
I almost got into a heated argument with my dad, who is 80 years old, when he was saying that he's getting up every day at 4 a.m. and trying to do his puja, his rituals of like cleaning up the altar and like collecting flowers and doing physical abhishekams with milk and water and sandalwood and all these things. Spends like 4 to 5 hours every day, and he's feeling tired now with this age and everything. And I'm telling him to cut it down, and he kind of says, oh, I cannot cut it down. This is how I kind of reach whatever, right? So, and I told him, like, kind of in a crude way, you should come and attend Tattva Bodha class to know the deeper meaning of happiness and what you want to achieve. And, I mean, he's very well versed with Shankaracharya's philosophy and stuff, but he still doesn't want to let go of what he considers dear to him. So, yeah.
Well, daily puja is a beautiful practice, because it's a physical prayer, right? We can pray mentally, we can pray verbally, and we can pray physically. And so doing a puja, doing a ritual, is a physical prayer. And it's a beautiful meditation. It's not to, I don't think it's to be discouraged. If his health is a problem, then that's one thing. But it's a beautiful thing. It's in no way contradictory to what we're studying here. But if he's spending 5 hours a day doing puja and something is suffering and he's too tired to get on with other things, and
exactly, that was my concern. And like,
yeah, but that's beautiful that he does that. Yeah.
I told him, God is in you, don't spend too much time, and he got upset.
It's very nice. You don't have to do an elaborate puja. You know, you can do a 15-minute puja. 5 hours, it sounds like a beautiful practice, but it's quite a commitment. All right. Any other questions? Comments? Okay.
Amazing.
What's that?
Yeah, it was a good discussion afterwards. Thank you.
Anytime. Good. I was thinking today I should tell you this without sounding too corny, but you know, this is really the highlight of my week. I look forward so much to these classes. I'm so grateful that you come and attend these classes. I just can't say enough about that.
It's the same for us too, actually.
Good. Good. I appreciate that. Good. All right. Until next week. Om Tat Sat.